This is Rabbi G, and welcome to Harvard God and Gen Z. The goal of this podcast is to discuss life's big questions with some of America's brightest young minds. We will discuss Harvard's continued sway on the imagination as the peak of success. We will discuss how to get there and what it is like when you do. We will then shift to discuss if and in what ways meaning and God are relevant features of Gen Z. What better place than Harvard for discussing these issues with the thought leaders of tomorrow? Okay, welcome back. We're here in our third episode of Harvard God and Gen Z. So I have to be honest with all the listeners out there. We may not be in the Generation Z range over here. It could be we're sneaking a millennial in this podcast, but I believe he is close enough to the border of Gen Z to qualify for the podcast. And nonetheless, is still on the pulse of current society. So we're going to let our dear friend David Kaufman in on this podcast, even though he might be millennial. Welcome, David.
Hey, Rabbi, thank you so much for having me. As far as I know, I am one of the younger millennials, so I really appreciate you bent the rules to have me on. It's a pleasure.
I think everyone will see why we did. It's going to be well worth it to listen from this very wise young millennial slash almost Gen Zer over here. As far as I know, David graduated Harvard about 3 years ago. He's been out in the work world a little bit. So before we get to your experiences out into the work world and your Harvard experience, please tell us a little bit, David, where did you grow up?
Sure thing. I grew up just outside DC in a little suburb of Maryland. I used to tell people that it was six houses from the border, so about half a block. And I went to school in D.C. I went to a Jewish day school through sixth grade. And then I went to middle school and high school in the district proper, Woodley Park. And then I went to Harvard, graduated class of 2017. And I've been working in consulting ever since.
Wonderful. So tell me a little bit about the journey down memory lane a little bit. So did you grow up in a particularly academic family? Was education really stressed? Was it in a pressure environment to excel? Or is that something you did on your own? What was it like growing up?
Yeah, my dad was a lawyer. My mom had been a teacher and had worked in marketing for a while. But by the time I was born, was a stay-at-home mom. And my parents, I think, were very supportive. You know, I always knew that my education was my own. My mom would often tell me that. So I always felt like I was, you know, putting in work and trying to earn grades sort of for my own sake. You know, of course, when I did well, my parents were happy, but it was never like you have to get such and such a grade, or if you don't get this grade, we're going to, you know, discipline you in some way. So mm-hmm. I think it was pretty healthy. They encouraged my sister and me to, you know, pursue learning for its own sake. I think we were naturally pretty curious. And I think that was a very healthy way to do it. I knew people where it was more, you know, I'm not very interested in what's going on. I'm only doing it because my parents are pressuring me. For me, at least, I think the slightly more hands-off approach, you know, I didn't really talk about my report cards very much with my parents or things like that. I think that provided.
But would you say, did you have an inner fire, or you're saying you just had a natural curiosity just for knowledge? What was it?
Yeah, I mean, I think a little bit of both. I mean, I generally enjoyed school. I thought learning was pretty interesting and it felt good and it was nice to feel like I was making progress. You know, I do think, you know, I came from a family where, you know, my dad has a law degree. My mom has a master's. You know, almost all of my relatives went to prestigious universities. A lot of them have multiple degrees. I think there was something in the air where I had a lot of role models who had done well academically, where that was sort of what I expected to do. Mm-hmm. So I think that background was a part of it. But I do also think that sort of naturally, you know, school came pretty well. You know, if I showed no interest, maybe my parents would have taken a different approach. But I mm-hmm. think they understood that I was, you know, I was going to put in effort and put in work.
Did you ever have to overcome any challenges in that respect? Were there any, or did you find school always to be somewhat doable, perhaps easy on the easier side?
I mean, it was usually pretty doable. There were a few classes I took when I was in high school. I took math with students who were a year older than I was. It's sort of a little bit of an accelerated track. And one of those years in particular was pretty tough. The teacher, looking back, it was a great learning experience, but the teacher was, we didn't have a textbook, he didn't check our homework. It was very much, you know, he treated us as adults, as he would say, and we would come into class and he would call on someone and ask them what problem they found to be the most interesting. And they would sort of explain the problem and their thinking, and then he would ask the rest of the class for their thoughts. And it was much less about, you know, getting to the right answer and more about giving us very challenging problems that he knew we couldn't always solve, and encouraging us to think through them and structure the problem and think critically. So then I would go to study for a test and I'd have like three lines of notes from the last month, because it wasn't about memorizing formulas or anything like that. It was just about learning how to think. And it was tough. But later on, when I took other, you know, especially math or science classes, I realized that it had been a huge gift. Because when I was then faced with difficult problems, it wasn't the first time I had that feeling of, where do I start? How do I make heads or tails of this? And it was a very, you know, that's much more powerful than, you know, memorizing a bunch of formulas you're going
to forget. But it was slightly painful at the time, but long-term payoff.
100%, yeah. I missed the other big challenge. I missed my junior year, a lot of my junior year of high school. I had a pretty bad concussion playing football. So from about September to February, I barely went to school.
When you were away for so long? Did you have to stay extra or did you just make it up? How did that work?
Yeah, a little bit of both. It was a real sprint to the end of the year. I did write a few papers over the summer. My school was great. They provided me a lot of support and flexibility, so I didn't have to repeat the year. But I was really cramming pretty much, you know, all of my classes to wrap up. And, you know, take exams at the end of the year, things like that. So I would meet with teachers, you know, after school, before school.
Wow.
And at the end of the day, I probably did 85% of the work that my peers did, but that was okay.
So did that story make it into the Harvard essay? That's the question.
It did. Yeah. Yeah. My essay was all about, you know, having this horrible concussion, basically lying in bed for whatever, 4 or 5 months. And it was actually one of the first sort of things I did where I felt like myself again was I had some stand-up comedy in front of a big crowd. So it was all about just the story of, you know, feeling terrible and not like myself and sort of slowly getting back into the swing of things.
So you started feeling yourself again when you did some stand-up comedy?
Yeah. And that's actually what I wrote my college essay about. Just the story, the journey from basically lying in bed for 4 or 5 months and not being able to do anything, not really feeling like myself, and then signing up to do this stand up in front of a big crowd. And for the first time in a long time, feeling confident, feeling like myself, and feeling some adrenaline, some energy to try to make everyone laugh.
Wow, good for you, because you got to be a quick thinking, I assume, in stand-up comedy. And to put your mind from concussion state, I'm sure a little bit slow, to that environment wasn't quite a journey.
Yeah, stand-up is actually, it tends to be very rehearsed and very written out, I think. So I knew what I was going to say ahead of time, but it still took a certain guts or strength to actually do it. And it, once I did it, I just felt so much, it was kind of the only thing I had done.
Snapped you back into place.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Very nice. And did you do a lot of other extracurriculars in high school in order to, you know, the rumors have it that to get into some of these big universities, you need to fill your schedule with a million leadership roles and whatnot. Is that something that you did intentionally or didn't do intentionally and didn't care? What was your take on that?
Yeah. What's the joke? You know, how are you going to compete with the tuba player from Iowa who sort of ticks all the demographic boxes or whatever? Yeah, I think I did some extracurriculars. I was on a debate team. I played a lot of sports, football, basketball, baseball, a few other things here and there that probably weren't as notable. I think there's always a temptation to do extracurriculars just to put them on your application because you think they look good. I really do think it's, at least for me, it was more about finding things that I was interested in that I could write an essay about or that I could talk about in an interview. Because people can kind of tell when you do something just to do it. I think it's more about doing things you're interested in where you actually have something to say. It's a little bit less about what you do and more about what you do with it and what you can say. So, you know, I think in general for college admissions, you know, I got into Harvard and a few other places. I also got rejected from other places. And, you know, all you can do is put your best foot forward and, you know, get the percentages as high as possible. But I do think, you know, there are some boxes that colleges might look at, whether it's a GPA or an SAT score or whatever. But my guess is, you know, the reason they accept person A and not person B is not because person A did two more extracurriculars. It's because person A had a more interesting story to tell or, you know, really showed passion, insight into something, or frankly, just got a little bit lucky.
Sure. But you felt you stayed true to yourself throughout the process and you didn't put on a show for anybody. You were organically yourself and did your interests as much as you could.
I hope so. I mean, I'm sure that I played up whatever I did in high school as much as possible, but I don't think I did much just to put it on a resume, because to me that just felt like, you know, it wasn't going to be very authentic.
Sure. And what attracted you to Harvard at the end of the day? Why did you just choose to go to Harvard?
I actually, when I originally thought it wasn't going to be a good fit for me. I thought I wasn't going to like it when I visited. And I also sort of thought it's a crazy decision to make, right? Where do you want to spend 4 years of your life? Right. I sort of thought the only way to do that really would be to go to a few different places for a semester each and then decide.
Sure.
But obviously that's impossible.
Right.
And my mom really encouraged me to understand it was going to be an emotional decision. Mm. And a lot of it was going to come down to where do I want to wake up every day for 4 years? And it just happened that when I visited Harvard for Accepted Students Weekend, I had a great time. I met people I liked. I liked campus. Whoever hosted me was nice. The weather was probably good. And maybe those aren't, you know, the best reasons, right? If I did that 10 times, maybe, you know, nine of those times, the weather would have been bad and I wouldn't have liked the people I met, but it just felt right. And I was okay knowing it was going to be a bit of an emotional decision. I also didn't really know what I wanted to study, what I wanted to do. If I had had more of a technical focus, if I knew I really wanted to be a marine biologist, then okay, it's a little bit more about what, you know, is there a school that has a particular program or particular faculty, but since I didn't quite have that direction, I was okay knowing it was going to be a little bit more of an emotional. And I was very fortunate to get in and to have some good options.
But it's amazing you can admit that. Many people make decisions and then after the fact kind of rationalize it and give you all the reasons, the rational reasons why they do that. And you're kind of being open and honest about it. Yeah, it's an emotional decision. Could have gone either way. If that rained that day, who knows? But it is amazing insight that even some of the big decisions of our life, even four-year decisions that seem so big, at the end of the day, as you're pointing out, are really largely emotional. It's kind of hard to get around that because we will never have all the information and we just have to make a decision at a certain point and do the best we can and be okay with some serendipity on that.
100%. And I thought it was going to be a really hard decision for me. I usually take a lot of time and sort of agonize over things. And for whatever reason, it ended up being it wasn't something, you know, I considered it, but it wasn't something I really agonized over. And, you know, of course, again, I feel very lucky to go to Harvard. It's not necessarily a hard decision to go there.
Sure.
But I somehow convinced myself it was okay that I would be emotional. And I also knew that it was more about what I was going to do with those 4 years. That's really what's important than necessarily where it is.
So let's go there a little bit. So how did those 4 years go? At the end of the day, obviously Harvard has a reputation. Did it live up to its reputation? Was it exciting to be there? Did you feel like you gained something there that you wouldn't not have gained at other places? What was your experience like at Harvard?
Yeah, it was good. It was good. I ended up majoring in philosophy. And one of the other things that was spent a lot of time on, I was in an improv comedy group where I met a lot of great people and had a lot of fun. And, you know, there are obviously ups and downs as there are with sort of any four-year period.
Sure.
For me, I think some of the real highlights were the people, just the people I met that I was surrounded with. were incredibly talented people I could learn a lot from. Mm-hmm. And I also think in some ways I benefited from the fact that it is a big university, which can be a plus and a minus. But for me, I was able to take a class at the business school with this incredible professor who I ended up doing some work with afterward. That was really a real highlight of my academic experience. I did some work, some graduate students in a psychology lab that was doing some really interesting cutting edge work. And I ended up majoring in philosophy. And I found what for me was just an incredible, welcoming, tight-knit community and department there. So I really appreciated this.
People don't typically associate philosophers with a warm, tight-knit community. So this is a unique experience.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was a small department. There were maybe 20 or 30 students who majored in it in my year. And, you know, for the most part, you don't major in philosophy by accident. A lot of times when I would tell people I was majoring in philosophy, they would sort of look at me funny and ask me, you know, if I ever, you know, do you ever want a job or do you just want right. to have your head in the clouds? So I thought the students were pretty invested. And then the faculty, you know, similarly, you know, some of them weren't too interested in the undergrads, but a lot of them were, because there's not so much you do with a philosophy PhD other than teach. Right. And a lot of, you know, what makes you a good philosopher, I think also makes you a good teacher. It's all about presenting ideas very clearly, understanding arguments, you know, sort of reasoning with other people in a productive way. So of course, you know, not every professor, not 100%, but for the most part, I think the faculty was invested in the students, was invested in the teaching, and the students were also invested in the learning. And it was just a small group, and no one was there because, you know, they really just wanted to spend all time in a lab or, you know, doing their own research or whatever, because it just wasn't quite as, it's not quite as applicable in that department. And same with the grad students. Yeah.
Did you find the philosophy that you were learning, was it more technical, as you're saying, kind of more methodology of how to think and how to break down arguments? Or do you also feel the philosophy department dealt with some of the more intrinsic big questions of life? And did you go into it on some level to get answers to those bigger questions? Or was that just, or was the point just, as you mentioned before, you appreciate good thinking, that teacher from high school that taught you how to think, and you wanted to get those skills, and you were not necessarily interested in diving into existential questions through philosophy?
Yeah, for me, it was a little bit more the former. I'm a big believer in the liberal arts idea, where you learn a bunch of translatable skills. You learn how to think, you learn how to understand arguments, make arguments, talk with other people productively, read something difficult and understand what it means, and then apply that on the line however you want. And I thought philosophy was really, really good at that. Because if you weren't doing that, you kind of weren't doing anything. Like everyone knew there were no technical skills that we were learning. So it was kind of all you had was kind of the toolkit that I thought the department did a really good job of developing. And, you know, I think there were some classes that focused a little bit on the bigger questions. I mean, I think a lot of my friends sort of thought that philosophy meant ethics, which is one branch of philosophy, but is not always the main focus. So I took classes on metaphysics or epistemology, logic, you know, what there is in the world, how we know things, how we make arguments, a lot of which were a little bit more esoteric. So I took a class about Kant and his ethics, a class about political ethics, a class on Hume and his ethics. But I think a lot of the other classes were a little bit more academic. And in general, I didn't totally expect those classes to change my life in a practical way. I wasn't asking questions like, how do I live my life? And then sure. answering them through philosophy, at least for me. For me, it was more of that learning how to learn and academic experience.
And it seems that paid off. As I understand, after college, you didn't stay in the clouds. What did you do after college, and how has that experience been?
Yeah. After college, I started working on a big management consulting firm where I've been for the last 3 years or so. And it's been good. I was able to in some ways, it's an extension of that idea of liberal arts and that idea of philosophy that I invested in, where they're not, you know, the people who are hiring aren't really looking for subject matter expertise. They're looking for people who can learn quickly, who can present information and synthesize it effectively, who creative arguments, problem solve, things like that. And in interviews and things like that, I was able to tell a story about how the philosophy background, how the improv comedy background helped prepare me for all those things. And yeah, I mean, work is definitely different than school, but I think for me, the highlights have been, you know, every 6 months or so, I'm able to do a new project, a new case, learn a lot about a new industry, a new company, and get a lot of practice at working as a team, thinking and presenting information clearly, solving problems, structuring problems, these things that are very translatable.
Sure.
And very helpful in a lot of different contexts.
Amazing. And going back a little bit, so did you find, at what point, or have you found that during the university experience, perhaps afterwards, that what have you found meaningful in your life up to that point? And at what point, or have you started
becoming more meaningful beyond
just academic success or corporate success?
Yeah, I think a lot of the things I focused on are, at least in my mind, sort of growth oriented. I liked the feeling that I was getting better at doing the philosophy work. I've liked progressing in my career and going from, you know, in the first 6 months, not knowing anything and asking a lot of questions to more recently, you know, supervising people who are in their first 6 months or their first year and answering their questions, or seeing something that would have taken me 3 days to do now might take me half a day to do, and I'll probably do it better. For me, that's a really fulfilling feeling. And I get a lot of energy, I think, especially professionally, out of helping and coaching other people. And I think in school, I also got a lot of meaning out of, you know, finding and forming or building even communities. Mm-hmm. When I was in my improv group, I led the group for a year and we organized our first ever big festival. We brought in, I don't know, 5 or 10 groups from across the East Coast, and we had a big shows over a weekend and we met all these people, and it really felt like we were sort of creating. And I think that's still, I think they've been doing that every year since, which is sort of a nice feeling. Yeah. And then, you know, in college, I started reconnecting a little bit with some of my Jewish roots. I had gone to a Jewish day school and had a bar mitzvah, but since then it hadn't really been at the forefront of my mind. And I think that, you know, became another touchstone and really important source of balance and source of meaning. And especially, I think, since I've started work, where it's very easy to get consumed by and sucked into work, you know, the weeks where I felt the most balanced and the most full are probably the ones where I've had more connection to, you know, Jewish practice, Jewish thought, mm-hmm. and a reminder that, you know, work is good and productive, but it's not the be all and end sure. all, so to speak.
But you articulated something important. You said that work did provide a certain amount of meaning in the sense of both personal growth, the ability to give back to others and help them develop. You mentioned mm-hmm. the idea of the communities you built in college, which I assume you could build communities outside of college. Mm-hmm. So given that work does provide or has some context of meaning as well, what's kind of the difference between those two levels of meaning perhaps, or what was still lacking despite the fact that you were doing meaningful things through work? What was still missing, I guess, at the end of that?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a good question. And in some ways it's the million dollar question. I think for me, you know, at the end of a long work week, I felt fulfilled in certain ways, but I also realized that the work wasn't, you know, scratching every itch I had, in a manner of speaking. And, you know, sometimes, especially if the project was a little bit less interesting to me, or, you know, the work was a little bit more rote or whatever it was, you know, it was providing a certain amount of structure and a certain amount of, you know, growth, but it wasn't necessarily helping me, you know, be a more balanced person or a more moral person. And I think, you know, it also sort of, there were definitely weeks or periods of time where I felt like I was being sucked in or giving too much, and you know, the work became draining rather than energizing. And when I was able to have, you know, a little bit more balance and a little bit more time for myself or time for a Jewish community, it felt like that not only was good in and of itself, but it provided some boundaries and some structure around the work that made the work itself feel a little bit better, where it was one part of my life rather than the sum total. And I think... So,
can you just describe for a second, you mentioned the itch. Can you put words to that? The itch you were feeling, or you said that even with when work is pumping well, there's still an itch even beyond that that you feel needs addressing.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there were periods where I was more focused on work and the Judaism part receded a little bit. And I think I realized that a lot of my time was either working or, it was working hard, or I had worked hard enough that I could take a break from working. And those were kind of the two modes. Right. And then when I was on those breaks, it was a little bit, felt a little bit empty, and I was sort of not sure, you know, aside from sleeping in or relaxing and watching TV or, you know, seeing friends, all of which are nice. Right. If it was only as an expression of not working, it felt a little bit hollow at a certain point for me personally.
Sure.
And I think when I was able to instead feel like that time was positively used to connect with community or to learn or to, you know, feel a deeper connection, then it became, rather than, you know, sort of an absence of work, it became the presence of something else that for me, at least, you know, at this point in my life is feeling more meaningful.
Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think, I mean, you mentioned kind of it's a personal feeling on some level. Do you believe though that everybody on some level, if they're just working, that everyone has that itch on some level, and it's there but not expressed? Or do you feel some people can derive a 100% almost fulfillment from work and kind of be happy that way, and that works for them, and it's great? Have you seen that?
I don't know. I mean, my grandfather was not religious. He owned a meat store. He was a butcher on the Lower East Side of New York. And when he was 98, in his last couple of years, you know, his memory was going, I'd say, "Hey, Grandpa, tell me about the meat store." And his face would light up and he would get so happy. And he could still tell me about, you know, waking up at 3 a.m. to go to the meat market to pick out the cuts of meat, spending all morning cutting it and cleaning it. And he got so much joy out of it. And he loved what he did. He loved working with his hands. So I don't know. I mean, I think it's possible. I think for me, at least in this context, it's felt more complete when I've had a few other things in my life. I also think it's very difficult to find a job that you like as much as my grandfather seemed to like his job.
Sure.
So it could be that, you know, if I were doing something else, maybe I would feel complete professionally. But I think the majority of people, I mean, I would love to find a job, you know, find a job you love and never work a day in your life. I think that's a really good goal. I think it can be very difficult to find though.
Sure. And so you mentioned that when you fill your life with something more meaningful or more balancing, community oriented, maybe perhaps learning oriented on your downtime, that gives you that balance that you were seeking. How would you articulate to others? Because at the end of the day, I don't know how many people are as proactive as you have been in filling up that space. Do you think that's something that the reason why it's few and far between is simply because people don't recognize how to fulfill it, or are there other blockages you feel that keep people from kind of perhaps getting a more balanced life?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think for me, at least, you know, there's a few things that come to mind. One is, you know, it's been many years, you know, 3 years of working plus 3 or 4 years of college where I was dipping my toes into Judaism. It's taken a long time to figure out what feels balanced, what feels good, what feels meaningful. And it's tough. I mean, figuring out, you know, what's important and setting priorities is something that, you know, I think is probably a lifelong pursuit. So I think number one, it's difficult. Number two, I think it's so easy to feel, especially in my experience, it was very easy to just be so busy that I didn't have a lot of time to reflect. And if I wasn't actively working or planning or traveling or whatever, I was so tired and exhausted from all of that, that it was hard to sort of take control and set a schedule. And, you know, I think in college, there's this feeling, I had this feeling that there weren't that many times where I needed to be doing something, but pretty much every time I could be doing something, there was sort of this, there was always something I could be doing. Whereas in work, it's sort of this concentrated, you know, work for, in my case, you know, 10 or 12 hours a day, whatever, and then have some downtime on the weekend. But in both paradigms, there was just, at least for me, a feeling of, you know, more work than there were hours in the day, necessarily. And I was always a little bit behind. Mm-hmm. So I think it's hard to take a step back and take a deep breath and, you know, assess how things are going and then figure out what, you know, tweaks or changes or modifications you want to make to move things in a more, you know, balanced or sustainable direction.
So that's a beautiful insight. It sounds like you're saying that in college, it's very hard to have, you know, that mental clarity to think about these things because there's so much going on. And at work, it's almost you're too exhausted to delve into some of these aspects, mm-hmm. Evaluative aspects, personal reflection about life. So it sounds like the key ingredient to really getting in touch with kind of that itch and is setting aside some time to reflect and to have some downtime enough to be able to think. And it's almost like our culture. I remember in college, people kind of thought it was a badge of honor to be super busy. And I almost feel like that's kind of our society today. There's like a badge of honor to be incredibly busy.
100%. And I'll maybe just add one other thing. You know, I think it's number one, identifying priorities, two, finding the time to reflect and act on those priorities. But number three, I think, is finding a good role model or role models or a good book or, you know, whatever it is. The broader point, I think, is just that we, you know, there's no class you take about, you know, what does good life look like or what is important to you, or at least no class that I took, maybe there were. And I think it can be very easy to get caught up on the path that you're on, you know, with classes and extracurriculars or, you know, work and family, you know, things that are good, you know, things that are important and meaningful. But I think for me, it was very, very helpful to find folks who were living, you know, lives that looks good to me. And I could sort of say, hey, that looks good over there. Let me talk to this person and understand where they came from, where they're going, what's important to them, and ask some of these questions and have a very honest discussion. Because I think it's something where there's, at least for me, there wasn't really a roadmap on, okay, kid, now you're in the world, you're working hard, you know, here's the roadmap for making sure you're happy, making sure that you're feeling like things are sustainable and that things are meaningful.
It's pretty amazing what you're saying, that kind of some of the most important ingredients of life almost are so missing from the curriculum, the official curriculum of the institutions on some level. And it's something that you kind of have to supplement outside of that to find it. And it's so hard to get close to people nowadays because everyone's busy, everyone's running around. Mm-hmm. It's hard to find those people willing to role model and mentor that's not so available.
Yeah, for sure. And it's not so easy. I mean, I have a friend who's a little bit older than me, so he's been working for a while. He runs his own company. And I texted him and was like, hey, can I just like talk to you about some stuff? And we got on the phone and I was like, hey, you know, like, how is Judaism important to you? And just sort of asked these like very personal, like very basic questions. And he was happy to answer it, but it took a lot of, I was a little bit apprehensive to even ask because they're sort of weird. You know, people don't usually ask those questions unless you know someone pretty well. And I was fortunate that, you know, this friend was happy to talk and I had a few other people I could ask for advice. But I think, you know, sort of tapping as many people on the shoulder as you can who you think are good role models is definitely helpful.
So David, tell me a little bit, did the topic of God ever come up in your house growing up, or was that taboo or just not important? What was What was that about?
It didn't come up a lot. You know, as I said, my sister and I went to a Jewish day school through sixth grade that my parents were happy to send me to. But when we got home, it sort of felt like that you know, there wasn't a big emphasis on that part of life at home. You know, my parents were not particularly observant. And it was just sort of, you know, at school we do one thing and at home we do another thing. And, you know, I was 7, 8 years old. It didn't really cause too much.
But even the day school, though, you felt that there was an emphasis on the concept of God, or even that was just more cultural, traditional.
Yeah. I mean, we were learning Chumash. We were learning Rashi. You know, there were some pretty serious rabbis there. So, yeah, it came up. But I think it was hard to understand how it sort of affected day-to-day life when at home it really didn't, and it wasn't a big topic of conversation.
Mm-hmm. Was the concept of God something that you always believed in, or you also had trouble with at certain points in your life, or weren't sure about and then kind of came to it, or are you still struggling with it? What your personal
I think if you'd asked me as a kid, I would have said for sure, but I probably didn't really understand. I couldn't have given you a good idea of what it meant to me or how it, you know, impacted anything in my life. And then I think, you know, probably after my bar mitzvah through to college, didn't think about it very much. I was just very focused on what was in front of me. And, you know, every fall the high holidays would kind of roll around and I would say, oh yeah, that's coming up. And, you know, we go to synagogue for the high holidays, and it was kind of a nice introspective experience. And then I would sort of forget about it until the next year. I think it probably wasn't until college and after graduating that, you know, as I sort of become more of an adult and needed to figure out a little bit more about what I want aside from my family or my parents, and figure out what I want my adult life to look like. I think some of those questions are feeling more relevant.
Trying to figure out what you want. Do you find that what motivates you in a sense is kind of a lifestyle choice, or do you find there's a strong philosophical reason to believe in God, or you feel that philosophically, okay, you can go one way, you can go the other way, it's hard to know, so it's more of a lifestyle choice? How is the question for you?
Yeah, I mean, in the philosophy classes I took, God was often in the background, because a lot of the philosophers, especially from, you know, the early modern period or before, were pretty religious. Like Kant was very religious. Hume was famously suspected to be an atheist, which was like a big scandal. Descartes was very religious. So, you know, in their stuff, God sort of makes appearances, but we didn't really pick that apart so much. I think it was more seen as a historical curio than a piece of you know, academic analysis. And look, I mean, I think people are, you know, as far as I can tell, there are people who don't believe in God or don't think about God very much, who seem happy and fulfilled. And that's fine. I mean, you know, do they have a, you know, I'm not sure that it, you know, well thought out decision in every case, or it's more just a, you know, path of least resistance or sort of question that's not being asked. I don't know. You know, I don't want to speak for people. I think for me, philosophically, I'm not sure if you can, you know, I think there are very smart philosophers who live, you know, happy, productive atheist lives. And I think that's fine. I think for me, it's probably more, you know, I don't know if lifestyle choice is exactly the right term, but I think it's more about, you know, Pascal sort of has this wager about, you know, this famous Pascal's wager, right? You know, if there is a God, might as well believe. And, you know, if there is no God, then it wasn't, you know, that much effort. But I, you know, I think I might add another piece, which is, you know, even if it is all made up, right, it's all baloney, you know, if someone feels like forming those communities and having that structure and that scaffolding for their lives makes them less anxious, less stressed, happier, whatever, even if it's all on a foundation of baloney, sure, you know, I think there is some sort of practical benefit there as well.
Personally, you do think it could be baloney, or personally, you do feel kind of confident that you personally for yourself have a strong, like, which is there an argument that speaks to you on the cosmological, theological, moral Are there any of these particular arguments that speak to you directly more than a different
yeah,
one?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the philosophical arguments are just a little bit hard to, for me to put my, it's a little hard for me to put my eggs in those baskets just because, you know, so many of them rely on conceptions of, you know, the universe and cause and effect and these things that I think are really hard to actually nail down. And I'm not sure that I would, you know, I don't think that alone would sort of do it for me. I think, you know, correct me if I'm wrong. I think Rambam says you can get to, you know, belief in God just through logic. I think Ramban says you actually need to take a little bit of a leap of faith. I think I'm probably a little bit more on the latter side. I think it's more of a feeling and more of a, you know, looking at the consequences maybe than, you know, starting from first principles and ending with, okay, I believe in God.
Right. And you say consequences being that it gives you that meaning and gives you and that wager.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the other thing that is meaningful for me is, you know, maybe the Jews got it wrong and the Buddhists got it right, or the Hindus or the Muslims or the Christian, you know, whoever. But, you know, I have my great grandfather's Jewish prayer book, you know, at home, right? This was something that he was very meaningful for him and, you know, his parents and their parents, you know, it's something that I was born into where I have some connection. So if I am, you know, at a stage in life where I'm looking for something a little bit bigger to hold on to, like this seems like the one to go for.
That's a little bit similar to Rabbi Sacks talks about, that why not look, if you look at your family, look into a library and see that there's a book of philosophy, but you see it written by your family, that's probably a good place, at least to start. If it doesn't work out, then fine, you can move on. But it's some famous argument that he makes, that why not at least start at home, see what's see what's around, and then you can go from there.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, David, thank you so much we could talk to you all day. You have so much wisdom to share, kind of showing us that even after college and even in intense jobs, that seeking balance is worthwhile and something you've made a priority for yourself, and hopefully that will pay off in your life, and you'll be able to find that balance and that joy that comes from living a balanced life that's not completely one-dimensional, I think. Especially in America, it's so easy to be caught up in the one-dimensional lifestyle. And I think there is an emptiness that has perhaps engulfed a generation.
Thanks so much. It was a real pleasure.